bring the House Finance back to order. You know, we recessed last night so that we could continue this meeting this morning. We're going to be taking up Senate Bill 67, Claims Against Health Care Providers. I don't know if Senator Steakins or his staff is here, but they made the presentation yesterday. We were in the process of doing or hearing teleconference. I think we left off on Mike Hagan. So, but before we go continue the teleconference on this bill, is there anything that needs to come before the committee? Or Tim Foster?
Well, I wonder if I could join with Jim, Representative Holmes here from Fairbanks, who's saying happy birthday to Suzanne. She's been here a long time.
Oh, yeah. Can I say
and Mike Kelly. We could all say happy birthday to Suzanne.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Suzanne. Happy birthday to you.
Thank you. Did you want to say anything, Susan?
No.
Okay, for the record, and so everybody knows who the beautiful voices were that they were hearing, we have Representative Holm, Representative Kelly, Representative Foster, Representative Hoffer, Representative Robert, Co-Chairman Schnell, and Co-Chairman Meyer. Okay, to continue yesterday's meeting, we'll go right into the teleconference. First person on the list is Ken Brewer in Fairbanks. Ken, are you with us this morning? And would you like our singing?
Yes. Get down to it real well.
Okay, let's see. Can you turn it up?
Yeah, I did.
Okay. Can you say your name again, Ken?
My name is Kenneth D. Brewer. I live in Fairbanks, Alaska at 1701 Tamarack Street for the last 36 years. My telephone number is 452-2919. And today, I wanted to thank you, everyone there, for allowing me to speak with you. I sat here for 4 hours yesterday waiting to speak, but we ran out of time. Well, I feel kind of humble telling you my thoughts after listening to those important people who represent the doctors and their concerns for the insurance company. I do have some thoughts that I'd like to share with you concerning what these gentlemen were talking about and the way I interpret it. I agree. Heaven knows we need more doctors in Alaska, more good doctors in Alaska, but because we certainly have our share of bad ones, and that's for sure. We also need better insurance rates, not only for the doctors, also for all the Alaskans. You now have a temporary situation and a permanent solution before you. I thought what these gentlemen said about the shortage of doctors was, well, we know we've got a shortage of good doctors, but that's probably an overreaction to a temporary situation, since the popular thing to do is to overreact. On the other hand, you take SB 67, placing a cap and limitations on damages, that's pretty much of a permanent situation. It's also pretty much of a one-sided situation. It certainly is not in favor of any Alaska. I was thinking about what Jim Holmes had to say about insurance companies, and it makes sense to me that if you make money in Alaska, or if you can't make money in Alaska, you should leave, and that's what's happened to some of these insurance companies. Unlike Idaho, Alaska does not have the population base to support 10 insurance companies. Therefore, only the strongest survive, and that's called business. What really concerns me are all the Alaskans that go to work every day and cannot be here to tell you why this insurance cap cannot even be considered. When a person is damaged by a doctor, it's not their fault, and they shouldn't be penalized for going to the wrong doctor. The damages wouldn't be about money, but who's going to take care of the damaged people and their families? Who's going to stand up for their rights? I'll guarantee you it won't be the doctors, and it won't be the insurance companies. Doctors be granted the privilege of not having to accept the responsibility or accountability of their actions? Whoa! I can see it now. Whoops, made a $250,000 mistake today. Oh, well. Now, in memory of my wife, Diane Brewer, I'd like to tell you about two untold experiences. that we had with doctors. This happened a few years ago, and I'm going to give you, I sent you the information on this. I hope everybody has a copy of it. But we're going to be, the example one is a female, age 46, slim and trim, plays softball, skis, and loves to be outdoors, and never had a serious illness. I've been hospitalized other than to have a child. Now, she was working, the symptoms, she was working overtime and becomes dizzy and faints. Well, she's concerned, and she goes to the doctor. Numerous tests, x-rays, four doctors plus a radiologist later, and they tell her to go home and take an aspirin a day. 3 months later, she's playing softball, and she collapses on the field. She was brought to the hospital, placed in ICU, and the next day a different doctor is going to do some more tests. He looks at the x-rays, the existing x-rays. 5 minutes tells me that she has cancer of the lungs. Take her to a hospital in Anchorage, and they inform me that she has a fast-acting cancer that has gone from the lung now to the brain. She has an operation on her brain and begins the cancer treatment. The lady lives for 8 years, fighting cancer 2 times. Her quality of life during those years steadily decreased until she's no longer even able to move. She was never able to enjoy any outdoor activities nor sports, nor was ever and never able to work again. My questions then are, why didn't the radiologist recognize the cancer problem? He was paid for it. And I go, when four other doctors ordered up all those tests, I don't think they even looked at them because they didn't have any idea. They shuffled her from one doctor to the other. Now, if they had discovered the problem that she had cancer when she first went into them, would that have stopped the cancer in the lungs before it got to the brain? And then, after this happened, I tried to find an attorney. And you know what? I couldn't find an attorney in this town to take the case because they were all on retainers from the doctors. Now, what I want to know is how would you feel? Okay. Now, the second situation is, just a moment. Example two, same lady, different situation. The lady's eating a meal and has a seizure. She's taken to the Fairbanks hospital emergency room and draws a practicing physician who decides to keep the patient overnight just to make sure everything is fine. 5 a.m. in the morning, he calls and tells me the lady's dying. I don't understand that. He has a breathing tube installed down her throat and turns the job over to another practicing physician who specializes in cancer patients. He places her in ICU and leaves her there for 11 days, trying once to remove the tube. I go to another doctor who specializes in ear-throat problems, and he solves the problem within hours. A small operation, a tracheotomy or whatever you call it. 3 hours later, the lady pulls the feeding tubes out of her nose, and the next day is placed in the recovery room. The attending physician rarely visited the patient during this 11-day stay in ICU. After failing to solve the breathing problem, he was mad at me for asking him to remove the tube. The problem was that he didn't know what to do, nor would he ask for help. Now, why does unqualified practicing physicians are able to, let me read this because I'm getting excited. I'm sorry. Why do they allow unqualified practicing physicians to accept emergency room patients? That's a hospital there, okay? And they do this, okay? If there had been a doctor on call that knew what to do, I could have saved myself all that money that it was costing me per day, plus the life-threatening situation the doctor placed my wife in. Did the doctor that solved the problem say anything to the in-charge physician about, hey, you should maybe not do these things? No. Did the hospital staff say anything to me about that maybe there were other doctors that could have solved the problems? No. Did the in-charge discharge doctor ever say, I'm sorry, I'm not qualified to do this kind of work? And is he still taking emergency room patients? You bet he is. That's my problem. I can only say now that by allowing a cap to be placed on any kind of damages done to anybody is should not be done. That's not correct. And I'm sorry, I'm getting excited again. Let me recoup here. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Brewer. Is there any questions? Representative Holm has a question for you, Mr. Brewer.
Ken, yes. This is Jim Holm. I really wanted to thank you very much for your testimony. I knew your wife, Diane, very well, and I know it must be very difficult for you to make this call, but we're very best to take your information into consideration. So thank you very much for testifying.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. Good. If you see no other questions, then we'll go on to Roland Gower. It must be Dr. Gower at the Alaska Regional Hospital.
Hello, yes?
Dr. Gower, go ahead, sir.
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
We can hear you loud and clear.
Okay. thank you very much for the opportunity to speak this morning. I know I have to be off to surgery here in a minute, but I did want to call in and address an issue that I've heard has been kicked around down there the last several days. It's a beautiful morning in Anchorage. Hope you have the same in Juneau. A little background on myself. I've been a practicing physician in Anchorage, Alaska since 1975. I'm a general surgeon. I've been active in asthma since coming to Alaska and president-elect this year, and also have been on the board of Alaska Physicians and Surgeons, and have been through two of the semi malpractice issues, crisis, at least from a doctor's standpoint, and what's happened with availability back in the 70s, and then what happened to our premiums in the 80s of mine particularly pushing $100,000 in the mid-80s, and feel like what is happening now in Alaska, and for people who monitor this and look at it much more closely from a statistical standpoint, such as the American Medical Association, that Alaska is in a crisis route. I wouldn't say that we are absolutely in a crisis now, but we all know about the companies that have left the state that are writing insurance, and also I can speak personally that my insurance premiums have doubled in the last 3 years. But one of the issues that is more important, I think, than us dealing with our cost of insurance and whatever, because as long as it's available as a business person, that's a cost that's normally passed on to the patients, and that's that's part of what happens, and it's just something that drives up the cost of medical care, which we all are trying to address and whatever. But when premiums go out of sight, if you want to continue to practice, then you have to find a way to pay for it. And in reality, you can do that to some extent, except in today's market with the preferred provider relationships and no way to actually raise your fees without an insurance company's approval, because they pay you what you agree to accept, and it is hard to do that, and there is some concern that as premiums go up, the issue of who's going to pay for that. But more importantly, what I'm concerned about, and I think what I would like for all of you to understand, and I understand there's been some dispute about that, is the availability of medical care in Alaska, and my concern that's going to become more of an issue if we do not solve the issues that are addressing us concerning malpractice. I've heard or read in the paper this morning a report, I guess it's from the Legislative Research Committee or something, about how there is not a shortage of doctors in Alaska, and heard something about there being 2,500 licensed doctors currently on the rolls in Alaska. I can say that there is a problem with access or a shortage in Anchorage as far as in the areas that I practice. And the only, I think this figure must reflect the number of people who have applied for license, who have active license in Alaska, who aren't actually here. One of the things that happens is that many doctors, in order to go on vacation, have to hire a physician to come up here and work for them a week or two out of the year, and those are called locum tenens, and all those people have to be licensed, and of course they hold active license, but they're not here more than a week or two out of the year. Also, there are plenty of retired physicians that have active license and aren't practicing, and so I'm not sure where that number came from. The other thing that concerns me about physician access is the fact that half of us in Alaska, and I'm one of them, that are practicing today are over 50 years old. And if there becomes a problem with availability of insurance or premiums that just don't make sense, I personally am not in a position to retire from practice financially. But what I would do is limit my risk if I had to go bare, and specifically my highest risk is in the area of breast cancer, where I treat over 100 cases of breast cancer in Alaska a year and probably have 15 to 20 patient encounters related to breast issues every week in my practice. And statistically, it's a matter of not if I get sued, but when, from a general surgeon standpoint. And it would be ludicrous for me to continue to practice in an area, and not ludicrous. So I just don't think I could tolerate the risk if I was bare, if insurance became unavailable. Also, with half of the physicians in the state being 50 years old, you know, they are still working because they like to work. Some of them are certainly in a position to retire, and I've talked to a number of my friends in this age category that say if insurance becomes unavailable or unaffordable, that there's no reason for them to continue to practice, and they certainly would not practice bare and risk what they've had, what they've accumulated throughout their entire practice just to continue to work. So I think that we are on a crisis course if insurance becomes unaffordable, or even worse, if it becomes unavailable as far as access to physicians in the state of Alaska. If there are ample physicians around and plenty of practitioners, then I would have to ask why it takes me as a referring doctor at least 3 months in most instances to get a patient into a gastroenterologist to do a colonoscopy. New breast cancers that I can't take care of, when we try to refer them to other physicians in Anchorage that practice breast surgery, minimum is 2 to 3 weeks and sometimes longer. A new hernia that would call my office today to try and get an appointment would be 4 to 6 weeks. And I, at age 60, am now taking ER call, where I've got the possibility to be up five nights a month, and that's the highest that it's been recently, because there are physicians in my specialty that are dropping out of practice and no longer have to take ER call because of their age. So I think there truly is a shortage of physicians in Alaska, and one of the things that has become obvious to me in trying to recruit and ask new young doctors to come up here is that when I started in practice 30 years ago, it didn't even occur to me to consider what the malpractice climate is nowadays in an area that I wanted to go to. And that's one of the main questions that you see youngsters that are coming into practice out of medical school today looking at is, you know, what's it going to be like 3 or 4 years from now as far as my malpractice premiums? Is it going to be like if I'm a neurosurgeon in Florida, where the premium could be $200,000 to $300,000, my likelihood of suit, etc. So I think there is an access problem, and I think to some extent it's tied into our availability of insurance and affordability of insurance. There's many other things I would like to say about this, but I know there are others waiting to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions, actually in any area, concerning issues of practice that I've experienced in the last 30 years in Anchorage, if any of the committee would like to address anything.
Okay, is that complete your testimony, sir?
I'm sorry.
Was that
yes, all you? I will. I know there's other, there that you've got a very long list of others, and I do not want to dominate your time, but I'm happy to answer questions if you have any.
Okay. Is there any questions? Seeing none. Yeah, I hope you were done there. I heard a pause. So
yes, I am complete. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Okay, John Bringhurst with the Petersburg Medical Center in Petersburg.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can, sir.
My name is John Bringhurst. I'm administrator at Petersburg Medical Center in Petersburg, Alaska. Been in hospital administration for over 30 years, the last 7 years here in Petersburg. I worked in a hospital in Southern California during the malpractice crisis of the 70s. I was there when the California doctors collectively went on strike for a three-week period in protest of the exorbitant premium increases they were experiencing there. I took part in the efforts there to get tort legislation passed that significantly altered the course of rate increases there. To this date, California legislation serves as a model for the reform movement across the country. My interest in seeing reform take place in Alaska is based on three things. Number one, the shortage of physicians in Alaska. When I look at what is going on in my own backyard in Wrangell, where they continue to pay the high cost of locum tenens coverage for their inability to attract a physician there, to Ketchikan, where their search for a radiologist is well into its second year, where the obstetrician there almost left the area because she couldn't recruit an associate and could no longer keep up the pace being on call 24/7, to Craig, where they have been recruiting for the past 6 years to attract family practitioners there. We can ill afford to lose any more Alaskan physicians. Number two, the loss of services. I see where obstetrics is no longer offered in the community of Wrangell due to the high cost of malpractice insurance. This is a very isolated community and does without this service at considerable cost and inconvenience. Many obstetricians in all areas have relinquished the obstetrical part of their practice, opting to do only gynecology because of the high cost of malpractice insurance. Number three, the unavailability of coverage. For the past 4 years, Petersburg Medical Center has had only one insurance carrier that will bid on our business. As a result, we have had to accept whatever rate and whatever terms and conditions they propose. If this carrier should withdraw from the market, Petersburg Medical Center would be forced with the option of going bare as our only option. I should point out that Petersburg Medical Center has never in its history had a successful malpractice claim and should be considered a very good risk. In summary, the need for tort reform across the nation has again reached a crisis stage. I urge the legislature to take a forward step in minimizing the negative impact it will have on Alaska. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, John. Don't see any questions. Also, for the record, Representative Croft and Representative Jewell have joined us some time ago. Megan LeMaster. And Megan, you must be a doctor. It says physician. She just dropped off. Okay. Maybe she'll come back on. Kathy Dale?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, Kathy, go ahead, please.
Good morning.
Morning.
My husband, my family, and I are victims of medical malpractice. I can't talk about the specifics of our case except to say that my husband has suffered permanent brain injury during routine surgery, and our lives are never going to be the same. Because of my experience, I've learned a great deal about medical negligence cases. That is, how difficult it is to bring a case against a medical professional. This bill limits the victim's ability to sue medical professionals who hurt or kill patients, even if the medical professional is negligent, grossly negligent, or reckless. Because of my work as a CPA, I understand the problems with the insurance industry's arguments for passing this legislation. But there are already existing caps in Alaska. The $400,000 for non-economic damages in cases where someone is physically injured or killed, and the $1 million for people who suffer a severe permanent physical impairment. By the way, a brain injury is not severe physical impairment. The elderly, those nearing retirement age, children, and at-home spouses do not have economic damages because their recent earnings or potential earnings for the future are very low. Only non-economic damages are available to these patients. If this proposed cap of $250,000 is adopted, citizens of Alaska will be robbed of their day in court. Patients will not be able to due to the cost of securing expert testimony and health. ask you not to lower this cap any further. In addition to that, if we file a medical malpractice suit, we take on a substantial risk due to Rule 82. This rule places a substantial burden for the doctor's attorney's fees and out-of-pocket costs on the patient if they don't win their suit. Once ordered, these can only be paid from personal assets or forgiven through bankruptcy. Unclear what the effect of the new bankruptcy law will be, except to make it harder for patients who do not prevail in their lawsuits. The attorneys in these that will accept a medical malpractice case also takes on a risk because all of the time, the costs come out of their firm or their own pocket, and if they don't prevail, they don't recover these costs. With a $250,000 cap, we would not have been able to move forward with the suit. The cost of developing our case would have been too great to afford us any benefit, even if we were successful and received a settlement. Because not only did we need to pay attorney's fees, out-of-pocket costs, expert witnesses, but we also repaid health insurance carriers for the medical payments they had made on behalf of my husband. There are several other issues that I'd like to relate to. The increase in medical premiums over the last few years is not due to the number of cases that were filed nor to the amounts that were awarded in those cases. It was due to the lack of the stock market crash and the fact that the required didn't have the value that were actuarially determined, and the only way to put additional money into those pools was to increase. We experienced the same thing with our homeowners policies, our policies, and our personal liability policies. Market has now recovered, but from all the testimony that's been given by medical institutions and doctors, it doesn't sound like their premiums have been reduced. It sounds more like the insurance companies are pocketing the extra money and it's dropping to the bottom line. California and Texas are two states that have a $250,000 cap. California's cap was established in 1976. Adjusted for inflation, that would now exceed $820,000. Overall, California's medical malpractice premiums increased dramatically following the adoption of this cap. They didn't stabilize until the voters approved Proposition 103 in 1988 to regulate rates. Former Governor Jerry Brown, who signed the cap legislation, stated recently that he would not recommend a cap for the nation because in the interlude, he witnessed yet another insurance crisis and found that insurance companies' avarice, not utilization of the legal system by injured consumers, responsible for excessive premiums. Saddest of all is the arbitrary effect upon victims of malpractice. That's the end of this quote. Only patients with large wage losses or medical bills are typically able to find attorneys in California. Medical malpractice. Texas passed Proposition 12 and promised an end to the state's health care crisis. The promise was for improved costs, access, quality of health care, and reduction in medical malpractice premiums for doctors. What the citizens have received after the first year under Proposition 12 is no measurable improvement in the cost of health care. The number of doctors has not increased, and insurance companies have tried to raise premiums 35%. Those statistics coming from those states do not bear out what Alaskan insurance carriers and Alaskan medical professionals would like us to believe. I realize this bill has already passed the Senate, and I'm urging you to not pass this bill and not to limit the rights of Alaskan citizens any further. Thank you.
Okay, Kathy, thank you for your testimony. I see no questions. We'll go on to Ray Brown.
Good morning. Is it Mr. Co-Chair or Mr. Chair? I'm sorry, Mr. Representative Meyer.
Mr. Co-Chair will work.
Okay. Good morning, and thanks for the opportunity to speak briefly. I am an attorney who, in Anchorage, Alaska, we also have offices in Juneau, but I'm one of the few attorneys, I think there may be another four or five, not many more than that, that actually litigate these cases, and I have done so for the past 12 years. So I believe that I have a pretty good pulse on the economic impact of this bill, and also a pretty good pulse on the status of malpractice claims in the state of Alaska in terms of payouts and in terms of claims filed. Just to give you an example, my firm and me personally, along with one of my partners, screen approximately 200 allegations of medical malpractice a year. Of those cases, we take between 5 and 7 cases after an exhaustive and oftentimes, if not always, expensive screening and rigorous screening routine. It includes not only our own, our in-house screening, but also the retention as a predicate for bringing these claims of objective expert witnesses in the field of practice specialty that the allegation occurs. And only after that do we, if we get an objective report from a physician, another well-qualified physician, do we bring these claims. So these cases are not filed willy-nilly. They're not filed frivolously. And I think that probably Dr. Gower's testimony and the Petersburg representative's testimony echo that refrain. To bring these cases, it is wildly expensive. To get a case to a mediation or trial, the last case that we tried, we had over $200,000 in out-of-pocket cost in before it resolved. I've had several cases with in excess of $150,000 in actual out-of-pocket cost. So these cases are very expensive. Any law firm or any lawyer with a brain would never bring these cases without doing the rigorous analysis that we do. If they do, they're making huge financial and economic mistakes. Let me just say that Dr. Gower has an excellent reputation in the community of Anchorage as a general surgeon, and it doesn't surprise me that he has a long waiting list of patients seeking his services. It would surprise me if Dr. Gower had medical malpractice claims that resolved unfavorably to him, given his reputation and integrity. What that says to me and what the Petersburg facility just said to you, that they haven't had any malpractice claims, suggests one thing to me, that if the doctors aren't committing malpractice, such as Dr. Gower, if Petersburg Hospital is delivering good medical care, why are the premiums so high? Well, the premiums are really high, folks, because we need insurance reform in this state and not tort reform. MICA was a very successful program administered by the state of Alaska and abandoned after it was lobbied heavily, at least my understanding, by the insurance industry to allow the insurance industry to compete and to write premiums in this state. If we really want to get to the bottom of this alleged crisis, bring in some of the insurance carriers under oath, ask them questions about how much money they have made historically in this state. Ask them to compare the underwriting philosophies and policies that occurred that resulted in some of the carriers that left the state during the stock market collapse in 2000-2001. Let me just make a few comments, and I want to tell you, we've already submitted information to you, and it should be clear by now from the empirical evidence that's been presented in packets that we have brought to you from the it's comprised of data from the Government Accounting Office, from the National Practitioners Data Bank, evidence that's not anecdotal, it's based upon historical and accurate and current facts, that this bill does nothing to address and will do nothing to address this perceived malpractice insurance crisis. First of all, if malpractice premiums had anything to do with attracting doctors to this state, I suggest we'd have about 50 neurosurgeons. Compare the neurosurgical malpractice rates in Alaska to that of Florida, and one would wonder why people aren't flocking from Miami to Anchorage. Compare the malpractice rates in California for all practice specialties to those of Alaska historically, and one would wonder again, if you cap these at $250,000, why wouldn't California rates be significantly lower than Alaska's? They're not. They have been historically comparable. Has that attracted doctors to this state? Absolutely not. But what this bill will do, it will affect, look around the room, it will definitely affect either you personally, your mother, your father, your wife, your children, your grandchildren, a good friend, or a friend of a friend in your lifetime if this bill is passed. It will eliminate children from bringing claims, such as the 12-year-old that I represented a few years ago who was misdiagnosed with gingivitis and who had acute myelocytic leukemia, who could be sitting next to me right now had she been diagnosed correctly. She was misdiagnosed, by the way, at two facilities within 3 days. It will eliminate the ability of stay-at-home moms and dads from bringing claims. Retirees, subsistence, people that live on subsistence, even disabled veterans or other disabled people who have a previous disability but who are malpractice on and who have significant non-economic damages will not be able to bring these claims. It immunizes effectively for that subgroup of people, grossly negligent doctors and reckless doctors. The 70% disability increase to 400,000 will have absolutely no effect on bringing claims for these individuals. First of all, let me tell you that the 70% disability bump to 400,000 will only increase the litigation costs in these cases, because we'll have experts battling over whether someone is 63% disabled, 68% disabled, 72% disabled. It will give additional defenses to malfeasance of whether or not a person is actually in that range. More importantly, and I think the real tragedy here, is that women, who I have represented, by the way, who have been rendered sexually dysfunctional by malpractice, that won't affect them at all. They can still go to work even though they have saddle anesthesia, which is they can't feel from their waist to their thighs for the rest of their life. It won't affect children who have been horribly disfigured from from malpractice, that is visible, facial scarring, etc., from going through life with these disabilities, because they can still go to work and they won't be 70% disabled. I really urge you to really consider what you're doing here. This is not a Republican or a Democratic issue. It is a public policy issue affecting the most vulnerable in our society, and I urge you not to pass this bill. At least look at it more pragmatically. Bring in people under oath. Talk to them. I'll come to you under oath. I'll present facts under oath. Bring some of these people that are presenting some of these arguments on television that are unsupported by empirical data, and bring them under oath and see who's telling the truth about what's going on here. I urge you again not to pass the bill, and I thank you for giving me the time to present to you.
Thank you, Mr. Brown, for your testimony this morning. Seeing no questions right now. Also, for the record, Representative Moses has joined us some time ago. Robert Sparks from Fairbanks. You still with us, Robert?
Yes, I am.
Okay, sir. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee. I'd like to summarize my position by saying that we have caps and that new, more restrictive caps are unnecessary. What we have is a malpractice crisis, not a lawsuit crisis. It was extremely shocking to sit through the testimony yesterday and this morning from the doctors and to hear them talk about the financial aspects of this without even one whit of concern about the injured victims of medical malpractice out there. I didn't hear one doctor say that they've done one thing to reduce incidents of medical malpractice at their facilities and in their hospitals. The bottom line here is that the first thing that needs to be done is we need to make sure. When you look at the objective evidence, such as the GAO study, there's a commercial jet that's crashing every day with no survivors. That's how many people are dying from medical malpractice. We need to have a requirement that any incidents of medical malpractice be reported, and that hospitals and doctors in all specialties have systems in place to work to reduce medical errors. The most important part of the tort system is that it deters risky behavior. For hundreds of years, the common law system has worked to develop the current system where people that are injured recover damages from the people that injured them in order to deter the people that are engaging in risky behaviors from damaging or killing other people. An example of this, if you want to look at situations where people have been trusted and either restricted from recovering damages or from not recovering financial damages, you got two situations you can look at. For years and years, we held the Catholic Church and priests at a higher level. You couldn't sue the church because it was a charity. You couldn't sue the priest because they were members of the charity. And what happened was we had a major betrayal of trust. There was no deterrence of the child sexual abuse that was going on because those people couldn't be held accountable. If you look at the Veterans Administration medical fiasco. If you under the Federal Tort Claims Act, you can't, if you're not an active duty military person, you can only recover your financial damages if you're subjected to malpractice by a doctor that's in the military or works for the government. So the bottom line is you have a system that I think most people would agree some of the worst doctors in the world work, have worked in the VA system. Some of the worst malpractice has occurred in the VA system.
Does that complete your testimony, Mr. Sparks?
I have a couple other points here.
Okay. Yeah, if you could please summarize and continue.
I think that the evidence that there's any doctors leaving the state due to the tort system or medical malpractice premium is way overblown and exaggerated. The statistics show there's no more doctors licensed in Alaska now than there was 5 years ago. There's another GAO study that was done by the federal government that shows that these are very questionable facts and that there's basically no evidence to support the claim that doctors are leaving any state due to the tort structure or insurance premium. In fact, there was an article in a Washington paper a few weeks ago about a Washington doctor that said he was leaving Washington to move to Alaska because we had such a better tort system. The only beneficiaries of this legislation are big insurance companies outside of Alaska. State, basically, to summarize, I have to agree with Representative Kelly. You're never going to be able to legislate a good orthopedic doctor into the village of Tanana. You're not going to be able to legislate, and to expand on that, you're not going to be able to legislate and reduce people's damages to create more availability of insurance coverage. That's not the way the system works. Basically, what you're doing is you're putting the interests of vulnerable Alaskan victims of medical malpractice ahead of...
Hello. Does that conclude your comments, sir, Mr. Sparks?
I have to go.
Okay. If you were here in Juneau, we'd make you buy us donuts, but that's okay. We'll go on now to Mr. O'Brien, who's also in Fairbanks. Mr. O'Brien, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, go ahead.
Good morning, Co-Chair Myers and distinguished committee members. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. You know, there's been so much good testimony this morning that I would like, in opposition to this bill, that I think a significant amount of the pertinent points have been covered. What I'd like to do is just share very briefly with you a personal perspective. I am an alleged victim of medical negligence. I'm coming to you also as an Alaskan, as a citizen, and as a professional. I am an anthropologist. And I have a lot of concerns about this bill at all these levels. As a victim, many of us have lived alternative lifestyles, especially in Alaska, if we look across the board demographically. And as been noted in previous testimony, it will be those that are in the higher income brackets and who have sustained those incomes over time that will be able to get representation in the future should this bill pass. Any of us that have lived alternative lifestyles, let's say for instance, subsistence lifestyles, or that we've challenged ourselves, like in my case, to go back to school in advanced years and gain upper, you know, graduate degrees, that'll place you in a situation to where you can't demonstrate earning. Basically what you have there is student loans. If you happen to be hit with something such as a negligence at that point, a medical negligence, in court, you won't be able to demonstrate economic loss to the degree that you'd need. And I can guarantee you, I can tell you, as a person, as a fellow Alaskan, it is very difficult right now, today, to gain a qualified representation by a malpractice attorney. They are thorough. There is none of this chicanery and shenanigans out there that stereotypes would imply, that with ambulance chasing and trumped up cases. All of the attorneys that I have talked with have screened me thoroughly and discussed with me the situation and have cautioned me about how difficult it is to proceed with a malpractice case in Alaska today. I can just tell you that if this cap is put into place, persons such as myself will not have any opportunity to have a day in court. We have a wonderful system. It already exists. We have court, juries of our peers, and so forth. We have existing caps that are more than adequate to look out for the needs of defendants and insurance companies. I urge all of you to look into your hearts and ask yourself, and perhaps maybe some of you have been injured through medical negligence, but ask yourself, how would you feel if you were in our situation as a victim right now, and not only having to absorb the uncertainty of your future, the financial trauma and emotional, physical trauma, what it does to your family, but then this burden of worrying about legislation that looks as if it just callously casts you aside. So, gentlemen, please consider our voices, hear us, and do the right thing. Do not pass this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. O'Brien. Are there any questions for Mr. O'Brien? Seeing none, thank you again for your testimony. Next, we will go to Valerie Nelson in Sitka.
Representatives, my name is Valerie Nelson, and I want to thank you for allowing me to testify this morning. I have to apologize because the testimony of Mr. Brown was very compelling and brought out the emotions. I'm a former mayor, and I'm also a current assembly member, and you would think that I would be able to speak better than I am right now, but I'm going to try and be brief, as I've already sent all of you a one-page letter outlining my concerns with the passage of this bill, and I would respectfully request that it be read into the record. I am a breast cancer survivor of stage 3 infiltrating lobular carcinoma with a tumor of 10 to 12 centimeters. I underwent a double mastectomy a year ago, and as I was laying in the hospital here in Sitka recovering from a severe staph infection, one of my care providers came in and said, "Gee, Ms. Nelson, we pulled your records after your diagnosis, and we, if just one of us would have thought to do a biopsy, you wouldn't be going through all of this." And I had sought out care for 2 or 3 years here with concerns that I had with lumps and was repeatedly told not to worry, not to worry. Well, it's human nature when you have good news to not worry. However, when I was finally diagnosed in Seattle a little under 2 years ago, my care providers stated that they figured that the cancer had been growing for 3 years. The radiologist that misdiagnosed it the first time was asked to resign from her job due to alcohol concerns. And in hindsight, I wish that I would have sought a second opinion from the good news. But this is still very emotional for me, and it's difficult for me to try to explain to a number of gentlemen who are complete strangers the damage that is done when a woman has to have her breast removed due to negligence. And please, once again, I ask you to read my letter and read it into the record. And I would remind you that doctors are not the only ones that are faced with increased insurance costs. Our family owns a general contracting company here in Sitka, and our premiums have gone out of sight. If you pass this bill, does your body then plan on fixing our insurance problems? Thank you for your time.
Valerie, thank you for your testimony. Terry Gottstein in Anchorage.
One second. Hi. I'm sorry. I hope this connection is good because I'm on a cell phone. I'm calling to urge you to vote against this bill. It's interesting to me because I see that people have been polarized on this issue. It's become a them and us with the doctors on one side and the lawyers on the other. And it's really about all of us, this bill. And the thing that disturbs me about this is that it's the insurance companies. It's not the doctors. I feel sorry for the doctors that they have to pay these exorbitant rates. If you're interested in reducing malpractice insurance rates, you're focusing on the wrong place. You need to focus on the insurance industry. I don't know if you realize this, but and it was highlighted for me by the doctor who testified from the Petersburg Medical Center, that they had a good risk record. They should be a good risk. Doctors are not experience rated the way we as drivers are with our car insurance. If you get in a car accident, your insurance rates go up. Okay, that makes sense. With doctors, insurance companies do not experience doctors, so that the good doctors are paying as much as the bad doctors. It's done by specialty. If you want to do something to reduce medical malpractice insurance rates, what you need to do is mandate that the medical malpractice insurers experience rate doctors. That will still give incentives for careful care, and it'll get rid of the bad docs and let the good docs not have to pay through the nose for their insurance. This is not a commonly known fact, unfortunately. And it is something that you could do if the reason for this bill is, in fact, to lower medical malpractice rates. I support all of the testimony that has been given opposing this bill, that in terms of limiting the ability of people to have their day in court, injured people who are injured through negligence. The other thing you can do with this bill is exempt cases of negligence. That's common sense. I can't imagine anybody not being willing to say, look, if I'm negligent, that's standard for negligence is very high. There should not be a cap on negligence. Negligence should be punished. It just makes sense. I'm sorry to be rambling, but I'm on a cell phone and it's a little bit difficult where I am right now. So those are the main points. Also, that the experience in other states and here in Alaska is that the cap has no impact on lowering malpractice rates. None. That's a ruse. It's a way to divide and conquer. It's a way to pit us against each other instead of saying, how can we work together on this and bring down rates? The way to bring down rates would be to experience rate doctors, and to make the standard and to hold people responsible for their negligence. I guess those are my main points.
Okay. Thank you, Derek. Thank you for your testimony this morning.
Okay.
Okay, it's everyone I have on the list here for teleconference. Is there anyone else? Okay. We do have some folks here in Juneau. Pat Luke. Pat, there you go. You must have been in Anchorage yesterday. Right. Okay, very good. Welcome.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Pat Luby. I'm the Advocacy Director for AARP in Alaska. We're sure that none of our health professionals get up in the morning thinking about how many people they plan to hurt today. However, mistakes happen, even by our most skilled health professionals. AARP believes that our legislature should focus on preventing future mistakes. Focus on error reduction, not on damages. The tort system encourages providers to cover up mistakes to avoid lawsuits, rather than report errors and learn how to prevent them in the future. Let's not think about lawyers or doctors or insurance companies. Let's think about our citizens. If someone is hurt by a medical mistake, they're entitled to some form of fair compensation. But what is more important is to make sure that errors are reported so that we can learn how to prevent them in the future. AARP thinks that the $250,000 damages is too low for non-economic issues. Older people who have limited income potential based on life expectancy will get less in damages than younger persons who are victims of a very similar error. The Institute of Medicine has proposed testing non-judicial, no-fault alternatives to the tort system for medical errors. If Alaska would adopt one of the IOM-recommended alternatives, it would foster fair compensation and error reduction. AARP feels that error reduction should be the real goal of consumer-oriented reform. Under the Institute of Medicine approach, compensation will be based on avoidability of errors rather than negligence. The Institute of Medicine recommends preset schedules for compensation with reasonable limits that may help stabilize malpractice premiums. Providers would be required to report errors and make prompt compensation payments. The Institute of Medicine believes that mandated reporting of errors would help experts find system-wide ways to prevent them in the future. The system would then continually be improving patient safety. With fewer errors, the cost of compensating injured people would decline. We would have fair and speedy compensation, and we would have fewer medical errors. AARP thinks that we can all live with that. Thank you.
Very good. For your testimony. Seeing no questions. Thanks. Okay, let's see. I have Rod Bennett. I think Rod is the last one on my list here, unless there's someone who's come since the list. Okay. Okay, Rod?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Rod Beattie. I'm president of the Alaska State Hospital Nursing Home Association.
Sorry about that.
No one would really be able to pick my pronunciation up from that spelling. There's a handout coming to you, and I won't go through the entire thing, but I did want to touch on a few points from my members' perspective about what their concerns are around this particular issue and their support for this bill. Don't mean to diminish the individual testimony that you received from people who believe they've been injured and their right to pursue that and to get some compensation for that. Mr. Sparks mentioned no discussion on quality. I think that's simply because of the framework in which this bill is being discussed, and that isn't one of the areas of specific mention in the bill. I can tell you that hospitals have participated aggressively in quality measures along with the physicians that practice in hospitals. You can go out to a federal website now and see Alaska hospitals reporting against all other hospitals in the country and how they're doing in terms of those quality measures. And in every case, Alaska hospitals are at or above the national averages for those particular reporting requirements. And those things happen because you improve practice in a facility and because you improve your process. And I'll just give you one quick example of that, Mr. Chairman. The incidence of post-surgical infection from abdominal surgery averages in the 3-4% range in most hospitals. The intent to get that down boiled down to looking at the practice and procedure in terms of going into one of those surgeries. And what was found was that when you gave the antibiotic, and it had to be within an hour of the window of when you went into surgery, determined the likelihood that there might be an infection after the surgery was over. A little known piece of information which rapidly spread through the medical community, and hospitals are now using that to reduce the rate of infection when people go under the knife. And so there's a lot of those kinds of examples that we could share with you about what's happening in our facilities. But I'd like to come back to this bill. And some of the questions I think that come out of the discussion that I've been listening to. First one is, do we have an adequate number of doctors in the state? And whose numbers do you believe? If you go to page one of that handout, take a look at that population profile chart that's there. These are actual Bureau of the Census numbers. And that gives you the population growth in Alaska versus the United States as a whole for the period 1980 through the year 2000, and then the 2000 through the year 2020. If you look at Alaska's numbers, you'll see that during the 1980 to 2000 period, we had a 62% growth in the total population. They're predicting a 28% growth out to the year 2020. If you look at the proportion of those growth that are for people over age 65, Alaska had a 229% increase during the 1980 to 2000 period, and it's expected to be 109% over the next 20 years. Much higher than the rest of the country. That would explain why there's more physicians today than there were 10 years ago, but that the per capita number of physicians is not changing significantly. It also doesn't address the fact that because so many more are seniors, that the kinds of specialties we need in the state and the number of doctors in those specialties has got to be significantly higher than what we've had before. If you look at page two in terms of what the prediction is for our health professional growth, the chart there shows that for doctors, and if you look at the Alaska black line there, forecast of employed doctors per 100,000 population through the year 2006 is not expected to change significantly, a 1.9% rate of change. And that's employed under any kind of arrangements. And again, that underscores that we're really in a poor position now as far as number of doctors per capita, and we'll continue to be in a poor situation at best with the number of doctors per capita. The list issue, I think, is a significant one. Who has the right numbers? At some point, you have to get out of the truck and walk the field to see how many pheasant there really are. That's what the Alaska State Medical Association attempted to do when they came up with their list of doctors actually practicing in the state who are here full-time residing in one of our communities. I talked recently with the chief of the medical staff at Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation and asked her, what's your experience been in terms of the number of doctors that you actually need and how many are actually in the state and what are you doing to fill the gap? She said she needed daily 21 to 22 physicians full-time to meet the needs of their patients. She has 10 to 12. She has a rotating list of 50 locum tenens. Those are temporary physicians that come into the state to practice to fill in those gaps for, you know, a week or two at a time. And that every one of those, they have bought a license for those locum tenens for the full two-year period of time, would show up as active and participating on the list that you would get from the Board of Licensing. And again, it just underscores that that really isn't a good representation of the number of physicians in the state by specialty, by area, that are available to Alaskans when they need medical care. Second one is what services are most at risk? You've heard about OB, but there's also ER, the general surgery that's at risk, psychiatry, neurosurgery, cardiology. All rural communities are intermittently at risk while they're attempting to fill a vacancy and use locum tenens to try to get through those periods of time. And do we have examples of those kinds of problems? You heard a few today, but they fall into limiting practice, either by reducing areas and procedures that they have excessive risk, or maybe limiting their hours, and they no longer will do ER calls. And we know that that's happening in Soldotna for OB. We know it's happening in Wrangell for OB and general surgery. If you're in Wrangell and you have an emergency situation come up, like appendicitis, and you need surgery, you will not get it there. You'll be life flighted out. They do no surgery in Wrangell right now because they have nobody insured to do that or currently on staff to do that at the hospital. You could experience a delay. A case here in Juneau where the person was prepped and going in for a heart procedure, got bumped by somebody who came in the emergency room with a more life-threatening situation, ended up not getting the procedure that day, and then was told there was going to be a five-week queue, as you've heard from some of these physicians, before they could get back in line for what they needed. Ended up having to fly to Anchorage and make arrangements to get that procedure done up there. Very subtle effects, but the kinds of things that you're seeing because we don't have the right number of physicians with the right specialty in the right place. I think this is a public health issue. I think whenever you get into very sticky areas like this, you will have very strong feelings on both sides in terms of what the right thing to do is. We are not advocating this because we think rates will go down. We don't believe that. We hope it will moderate rates. We hope, most importantly, that it will keep insurers in the state and that they will see that it's a climate in which everybody's treated fairly. The patients, the medical community, the insurers alike, and that it will continue to send the message to the medical community that we want physicians to practice here. Physicians will have to pay for mistakes that they make, but they shouldn't have to pay for them egregiously and in a way that's going to hurt their ability to continue to do business here. And for those reasons, we think this is a good piece of legislation. It's been modified to create the two-tier system that existed before, but at a lower level. And my members would strongly urge your support for this bill and to move it forward for consideration on the floor. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you for your testimony, Mr.
Beatty.
Beatty. Okay. Yeah, it doesn't look like Beatty at all there. President Holm has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Beatty, thank you very much for your testimony. I guess the question that comes to mind to me is that if in fact the problem in Alaska, providing the proper medical care for all of the people of Alaska is a lack of physicians, or it's been alluded to, the anecdotal data we hear continually is a lack of physicians or a lack of physicians in the right, providing the service in the right areas. What, in essence, would Senate Bill 267 do for attracting even one physician? I haven't heard in all of the testimony anything that gives us anything but anecdotal data that it may keep people, it may support people for not being able to leave the state or not wanting to leave the state. But if in essence our problem is attracting more physicians, how many physicians will this attract?
Through the chairman, Representative Holm, I couldn't give you an exact answer to that. I believe that physicians look at a state in a broad array of factors when they decide whether they want to practice there. We don't have a lot going for us. We don't have a medical school here. We have very small residency programs, and most of the physicians that go to the state are either through their medical school or through the residency programs that they have participated in. But they do look at malpractice and the scope of liability and the cost of that, particularly with some of these specialty areas where, as you heard, they cannot raise rates to recover what those increased costs are. They have to pay that out of their existing revenue, and it continues to threaten the existence of their office as a practice. And so I think from experiences in other states that have this kind of a limit and what they've seen, and Texas was the most recent example, that you will have a different attitude on the part of physicians looking for a place to go about Alaska on this point than they would if we don't make this change in law. The other thing I would add, if you look at that chart on health professions at what the nurses' predictions are, that doesn't happen by accident. You can see there's a 13.6% increase there. The state has made an effort to graduate more nurses. We've had a program with Weber State out of Utah in most of the rural communities to increase the number of nurses that are in programs through distance learning to get them to an RN level. That's been augmented by the University of Alaska at Anchorage with a commitment to increase their graduates from 100 per year to 200 per year over the next 5 years. And you will continue to see the nurse situation improve as a result of that. We don't have anything like that going for us with doctors. So we have to be better at competing and advertising the state and showing that we do care about a doctor's ability to practice here and make a living, while at the same time looking out for the interests of the patients in the state.
Well, I appreciate your long but somewhat protracted answer. I still maintain that I would like to have a little more definitive answer, in the sense that is it going to help us get one doctor more? Is it going to help us get 10 doctors more? Is it going to help us get any doctors more? If not, what are we really doing here, other than maybe, as other folks have testified, minimizing the ability of folks to get proper compensation for actions not of their own doing?
Representative Holm, through the chair, my only answer would be, I believe we will. I believe it will keep current doctors practicing longer, and I think it will limit the number of doctors who have to reduce their practice because of the cost of this insurance.
Thank you for your answer.
Representative Kelly?
I'll pass.
Representative Crock?
Two questions really quickly. Was the prior testimony right that medical malpractice is not an experience base, that is, the premiums don't increase for the individual doctors based on their claims experience?
Representative Crofts, through the chair, I don't know the insurance actual rating system well enough to answer that accurately for you, so I would defer answering that.
I'm curious about that. I'd like to get an answer somehow, so maybe when we reconvene, somebody out there who knows more than I do on that. And the second question is, why not 100,000? Why not 50,000? Why not? I mean, what line should we be looking to draw here? Wouldn't that make us even more competitive? And zero make us the most competitive of all?
Representative Cross, through the chair, again, we're trying to find a balance. We're not trying to drive this to a level that's unreasonable. We think 250 is reasonable. It's what a number of other states have. It's what the president's advocating for as the reasonable level, with all of the research and support that he has behind his initiatives. So when we selected 250,000, it was with the belief that it's the right number for both patients who are injured as well as for preserving a healthy liability insurance marketplace.
Should it be indexed for inflation, or is it the right number 10 or 20 years from now?
My personal view is it should not be indexed for inflation. It ought to be something that the legislature addresses specifically if there's a need to increase it.
So we ought to periodically come back and see whether we ought to reflect the impacts of inflation on it?
In my view, that's something that's always open to the legislative body, and I think it's an appropriate policy decision for the legislature to make.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Crawford. Representative Crawford, I didn't hear your first question that you needed to follow up on.
There have been testimony before by Terry Gottstein that unlike car insurance, where if you have claims, your individual insurance rates go up, that medical malpractice for doctors wasn't experience-based. That is, it didn't change if you had two or three claims. I don't know whether that's true or not. It piqued my curiosity, though. And, I'd like to know.
Very good. Yeah, I apologize. Never thought it'd be too hot in Juneau. We have to have the windows and doors open, but it's nice. But it does make it difficult here sometimes. So you heard Representative Croft's question, and maybe what I'd like to do is bring this back up first thing when we come back at 1:30. I'd also like to have Senator Seifert come back so we can ask questions for him. That does conclude our testimony, as far as I have on my list here. Anyone else? Okay. There did appear to be one amendment that looks fairly small. We could go ahead and take the amendment, have the bill before us, and then discuss it in a little more detail in this afternoon when we reconvene.
Mr. Chairman, might I request that if Senator Seekins or Brian Hove are going to be here, that would be a more appropriate time for me to move the amendment.
And if anybody else has any amendments, just bring them forward this afternoon. And like I said, we'll take this up. I think probably somebody else would take them up first, but I think this one will be relatively short, so we'll take this up when we reconvene at 1:30. So with that, we are recessed at 1:30.